Welcome back to the Our Voices podcast. This week's guest is the academic philosopher and political theorist Charles W. Mills. Mills is a professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and author of multiple books, most famously The Racial Contract, published in 1997. This conversation with Mills and Our Economy's Europe editor, Laura Basu, delves into the concepts of racism and capitalism, dissecting the historical role of the nation-state, and asking whether any form of capitalist system requires racial differentiation, and thus racial discrimination. For the other interviews in our series on capitalism and racism, including conversations with Vijay Prashad and Gargi Bhattacharya, head over to opendemocracy.net/our economy. So here is Our Voices interview with Professor Charles Mills.
Charles Mills, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation, Laura.
So how would you, given all this, what's been happening, the murder of George Floyd and the resurgence of, you could say, an international racial justice movement, how would you answer that question? The question, is capitalism racist?
Well, that question for me is not controversial. It's obvious that capitalism has historically been racist and currently is still racist. The more interesting question, I think, would be, is this a matter of necessity? Is it sort of intrinsic to the structure of the capitalist system as such? Or is it contingent in the sense of the way it developed? Or even if you could say it had to develop that way, is it still necessarily racist going forward? Those questions, I think, are the more controversial ones, and those are the ones that are more open, because in a sense, you know, we have to see. It's not the case that you can sort of, you know, conduct an experiment and say, run this capitalist system, and see what happens. So we sort of have to look at the actual historical evidence so far.
So what do you think then? Do you think that capitalism requires racism?
There's some people have argued that, for example, if you make the case that you need a certain amount of primitive accumulation, to use, you know, Marx's term, you know, from Capital Volume 1, and that, you know, the norms that you're going to be basically violating will be such that you cannot do this with the population that, you know, with the modern epoch have reached a greater level of equality, in that, you know, the working class, one of the points that Marx makes repeated in Capital, the working class nominally do have equal status in the capitalist system, the time he's writing, as against, you know, the slave societies of ancient Greece and Rome, as against the serfs in medieval Europe. So the idea is they're formally equal, they're equal in terms of moral status, but they're materially unequal in terms of capitalist constraints. Nonetheless, they are normatively equal. So it means that you can't do stuff to the working class, let's say in England and Western Europe, that you can, you know, to a serf population, to a slave population. So if it's a case that you really need primitive accumulation, that you can't get it, you know, by processes intrinsic to the society, you know, where you have attained this level of, you know, moral equality and equality before the law, then, you know, you're looking elsewhere, and then you can say, well, maybe it had to be that way. So Marx talks, as you know, about the commercial, I mean, not the happiest of phrasings, commercial hunting of black skins in Africa, killing of native peoples in the Americas and so forth. So capitalism is sort of born in that. And then, you know, it's not that, you know, it starts that way and then it purges itself, you know, within a few decades or so. Because of course, with imperialism and colonialism, and as you said, you know, white settler states, it's consistently the case that there's a different set of rules for the European population, the people whom we come to think of as whites, and then native peoples in Australia, in United States, in some countries in Latin America, for example, Argentina, for example, sort of fits well in the white settler state pattern. And then, you know, African slavery. And African slavery has been so crucial to the development of capitalism. This is a case that was made years ago by the Trinidad and Tobago scholar Eric Williams in his Capitalism and Slavery. And he had great difficulty. It was his dissertation at Oxford. And the story is that when he tried to publish it, no British publisher would touch it. So he had to get it published in the United States. And now, though of course, you know, research and scholarship has moved on tremendously since then, I think there's a feeling that his basic thesis has been vindicated, even though you could quarrel about the details. And Sven Beckert at Harvard now, so you know, they're a respectable white guy, respectable white institution. That's what, you know, these scholars are saying now as well, that slavery is crucial to the development of capitalism. So there's a sense in which there's this massive sort of racially structured system built into it from the start. And I was talking about local American capitalism, we're talking about global capitalism, insofar as there's a triangular trade, and there's relations between Europe and the Americas, and, you know, cotton and molasses going back and forth and so forth. So in that sense, you know, there's a sort of, you know, crucial racialization of capitalism from the start. And of course, you also must not ignore the expropriation of indigenous peoples, because, you know, the land on which, you know, the capitalist systems of the New World are being established are originally native lands. And it's certainly not the case that they get a fair deal. You know, it's either outright conquest or it's fraudulent treaties of some kind, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the birth of capitalism is uncontroversially racist. For hundreds of years, it's racist. The question is, now in 2020, is it still racist?
And what about, so your book was about the nation state, really. It's about the racial context. Yes, so what's the relationship, would you say, between capitalism and the nation state? Was the nation state founded on racism, as capitalism, you argue, was? And does the nation state require racism?
Yeah. I guess I would hesitate to say that, in part because we think of how many nation states there have been. So, I mean, unless you want to define nation state in such a way that you're going to sort of exclude Asia and Africa, the West European nation state, you know, insofar as it's sort of, you know, linked with this global system, that certainly is racist. But is it necessarily the case that nation states in other continents, you know, did develop that way or had to develop that way? So again, there's a question of contingency versus necessity and a particular line of historical development. And then could it have been otherwise? And then even if, you know, it was structured that way, so there were these larger forces pointing that way, is it the case that the situation now is sufficiently different that you can imagine a non-racial capitalism, a non-racial Western European nation state? And these, of course, are the questions that we're going to see resolved or not in the decades ahead. So it's going to be hugely complicated, of course, you know, by the fact of global warming, by its sort of huge impact on the world economy, by, you know, the fact that this is going to sort of lead, on the one hand, you could say it might lead to an opening insofar as even the white working class, historically relatively privileged in the West European countries, in the European settler states like the US, Canada, Australia, even the white working class are now going to be sort of be pushed downwards. So in the US, for example, I'm sure you've seen some of the stories that there's actually been a diminution in life expectancy in the white population, that if you look at real wages, they've either been sort of stagnant or actually have gone down since the 70s. And class mobility, the US used to be very high on class mobility for whites, obviously, not for people of color, vis-a-vis Europe. Whereas I think now, with comparison to other Western nations, US ranks, you know, very much near the bottom. So it means that the system is no longer working, even for those historically relatively privileged by it. And you could say this creates an opening for a transracial class alliance between, you know, white workers being pushed down and people of color who have never historically enjoyed the kind of access, you know, to the system that white workers have. But at the same time, it could also go very much the other way, insofar as you could have an appeal, as you do have, of course, in the US itself, in certain European countries, in India, ethno-nationalism, so that we're going to hold on to what we have and sort of play up our whiteness. I mean, not our whiteness in India, of course, but play up our whiteness and, you know, in a time of crisis and time of shortage, you know, we're not going to sort of risk this alternative order you guys are proposing. We're going to hold on to our traditional privileges and make sure that they're not threatened. So it's a situation where, you know, it's going to depend on the political forces and whether you can have a political project that moves things in a more progressive direction as against, you know, the ethno-nationalist populist trend.
Yeah, I'll get back to this idea of a transracial kind of transnational movement, because I think that's really interesting. Can you just talk us through your theory about the racial contract? What was your argument, your core argument in that book?
My core argument, which, as you know, since you've read the book, I was immediately inspired by someone who spent a lot of time in Australia, though she's British, Carol Pateman, sexual contract, leading feminist theorist, a political theorist rather than a philosopher. And her argument was basically that here you have this central device, central to the Western political tradition of the social contract. And in the golden age is about a century and a half, from 1650 to 1800, which is Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, Kant. And the idea is it's illuminating to think of society as if it were created by people in a pre-social, pre-political stage, you know, the state of nature. And they bring society into existence and the polity into existence. And it's not, of course, meant as a literal account. It's supposed to be an illuminating metaphor. So the idea is the quality of people in the pre-social, pre-political stage should somehow translate into an equality in society and the polity. Then you get, of course, different readings about what that equality should be. So it's a way of, you know, approaching, you know, political theory with, you know, this model, as I say, not a descriptive model, a kind of metaphorical model, an iconography, etc. And Pateman says that's all very well as an ideal, but the reality is that women are not, you know, included as equals in the societies created, in you know, the parties that are created. They're sexually subordinated. So, you know, you can't talk about a social contract in an inclusive sense. It's a social contract that has as part of it a sexual contract with a different set of rules for men and for women. So that in effect, the social contract, insofar as egalitarian, it's an intra-male equality. So the guys agree to regard themselves as equal, and there's a contract among them to subordinate women. And then, you know, this manifests itself, of course, in women's lower legal status, social status, et cetera, et cetera. You can look at long history of sexist legislation, et cetera. So I was inspired by Carol's book, and I thought, wow, this is great, you know. I mean, of course, it's bad, but it's great as a concept. And, you know, can you apply this to race? So, you know, in the case of race, what you do is you say, let's look at the modern period. Let's look at European expansionism, imperialism, colonialism, white settler states, racial slavery. And it's clear that people of color are not included as equals either. So it's, in addition to being a sexual contract among men, it's a racial contract. So that then complicates it, because, of course, it's really white men, even though you can have patriarchal systems among people of color. But in terms of the people who have power overall, it's not men in an unqualified way, it's primarily white men. So the racial contract was then meant to say, if we're going to sort of do political philosophy with a contract idea, we need to work with a sexual contract, with a racial contract. And what they have in common is that they're contracts of exclusion rather than contracts of inclusion. They're contracts of oppression rather than contracts of egalitarian inclusion. And what that immediately does, it gives you a far more accurate factual picture of the modern Western polity. So parties that are representing themselves as liberal, democratic, and inclusive are really sexist and racist. And yet this might not seem like a big insight, but you know, if you're doing in 1960s, 1970s mainstream political theory, this central fact is not being admitted by these folks. So Carol's intervention and my sort of inspiration from her is basically saying, we're going to work with this mainstream apparatus and show how utterly misleading it is. So if you guys want to talk contract, let's talk about the real contract, the sexual contract and the racial contract.
So Western modern liberal democracy is yes. Based on sexism and racism.
Exactly. Though Carol thought of her book as primarily aimed at Western nations, but it's had a huge success outside of the West, because the contract idea, if you detach it from liberalism, just think of it in terms of an in-group versus out-group, in-group agreement to exclude the out-group. It can be applied to non-Western nations as well. So you have patriarchal systems in non-Western nations. So you have Carol's work being taken up by people, you know, outside the Western world also.
And what about the racial contract? Does that apply?
Outside? Racial contract, alas, has only had one translation so far, but a second translation, first translation was a Korean translation. There's a Turkish translation that's almost done. And there's a guy in France who's supposed to be working on a French one.
Okay. You've distinguished between racism and racial systems or racial domination. Sure. Can you talk us through what's the difference between those things and what's the relationship between them?
Yes, sure. Part of the reason it's important to draw the distinction is because racism is now used in such, you know, a broad set of ways. So, you know, when somebody uses a term, you're not really always sure what they mean specifically. So I prefer to sort of, you know, use the word racism more at the individual level. So an individual can have racist views, racist sentiments, and there are different analyses of racism. But I think, you know, the dictionary one is the one that I would support, which is that, okay, racism is a belief. One, the human race is divided into different races. And two, some races are superior to others. So that's a very simple definition, but I think that sort of captures the essence of it. So racism would be people who have those beliefs, and then you can have racial hatred, but you don't have to have racial hatred. You could have just people who are relatively indifferent to, you know, what's happening to people of other races. You know, there's a callousness, you know, it's not that they hate you, just don't care, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the definition in terms of particular beliefs is really the most important one. And then that contrasts with a racial system, for the reason that you could have people with racist beliefs, but they have no power to impose a racial system. For example, because they're a member of a minority group. Let's say you have a white racist guy and he's in a larger black nation. He can have all kinds of racist beliefs, but he can't impose, you know, white domination because there are just a few of him. So a racial system now is a system where a particular race or set of risks, more than one, are consistently privileged vis-a-vis other races across a wide range of social metrics. So for example, the economy, in terms of wealth, in terms of access to jobs and promotions, usually there'll be differences in terms of culture, which culture is a hegemonic culture. It'll manifest itself in things like life expectancies. Sometimes, you know, it'll manifest itself in terms of the body, in certain terms of certain bodies being stigmatized. So there's a sort of whole range of things. You could say that the economic dimension and the political dimension, because of course, crucial thing of political power, those are the two most important ones, arguably. But there are also things, you know, like culture and, you know, the body image and so forth. And then a racial system, as I say, has been differentiated from racism, because one of the interesting things from a sort of detached academic point of view is that a racial system can continue to reproduce itself even with a significant diminution of racism in the privileged race. In other words, racial advantage and disadvantage does not require racism. So in the US, for example, and I'm sure figures hold good for a lot of other Western nations too, but give credit to the US, They do keep racial statistics, whereas in some countries like France, it's very difficult to do that because of the self-conception, we're a republic, we don't recognize race. So in the US, for example, there's this huge wealth gap between white and black and white and Latinx households. So that's going to affect people's fate for generations to come, independently of whether or not whites are racist. You would have a kind of moral transformation that every white person becomes non-racist, and they see people of color as equals, but that huge differential in wealth will continue to give them an unfair advantage, even in the absence of individual racism of every single white member of the country. So that's why I think the distinction is so crucial.
And the racial system that we have now is white supremacy.
Yes, if you look at the global level, the most important racial system historically has been white supremacy. Though some people, you could make a case that in particular nations, you have black on black racism, maybe Asian on Asian racism, but sort of on a global level, it's been whites versus people of color. Yes, absolutely.
And thinking about, you know, the George Floyd murder and the other police murders and everything that's been going on in the States, and not just the States, but in many places around the world, it seems pretty clear that, you know, you have systems of racial domination that the state is racist.
Yes. There's been, in the left tradition, as of course you know, there's been a lot of work on the class state, the bourgeois state. There's been some work, not as much in the feminist tradition, Catherine McKinnon on the patriarchal state. But, you know, what we need is more work on the racial state. So there was a study of Nazi Germany, came out in the 90s, racial state. David Theo Goldberg, well-known race theorist, has a book sort of looking at the racial state broadly. But until a few, 1 or 2 decades ago, you did not have that much work. But there's more work coming out now. The idea of a state that's racialized, and as I say, privileges one or more race at the expense of others, either in terms of, you know, formal legal subordination, formal political subordination, or in terms of de facto disadvantaging, which a state that was committed to racial equality would not tolerate because it would intervene, but it basically goes along with it.
Why do you think this continues to exist?
Well, it's an unhappy fact about the human condition. I mean, you know, not to be sanctimonious, because, you know, we're all guilty of this. It's hard to give up advantages, moral suasion. You know, I'm a philosopher, so, you know, ethics is a big part of philosophy, but sometimes you wonder, why are we doing this stuff? Does it make any difference? Moral suasion has a very sort of limited role in making the world go round. And if you have a sort of old-fashioned left point of view, which I do, it's group interests that are sort of more important. So it's been in the group interests of whites, at least their perceived group interests, to maintain a system of racial domination, white racial domination, because they benefit from it. And were it to be the case that you have measures of racial justice to equalize the situation of people of color and to make atonement for the past of racial oppression, for example, movements for reparations, such as, you know, have in the US, and there have been attempts to do it internationally as well, you know, the global South making claims on the global North. This would mean, you know, a radical overturning of the world. If you can make a case, as many people you think you can, that the differential wealth of the global North and, you know, the European settler states, West European nations, is in large measure historically tied to this history of racial exploitation and racial oppression. So we're talking not maybe billions, but maybe trillions of dollars. So especially at a time of economic crisis, when people want to hold on to what they have, how likely is such a political and moral appeal? How likely is it that's going to be well received?
Yeah, and I find one thing that's really interesting about this moment is that people do seem to be questioning things on a very kind of deep and profound level. And there are some pretty radical demands being made, like reparations, like defunding the police, land restitution. What do you think of these
demands?
Well,
first of all, I should just say how immensely delighted I have been to see these huge demonstrations across the world, and to see, you know, the extent to which the crowds are multiracial. So that in some cases, in fact, you know, if you look at the demonstrations on TV, they're more whites than people of color. And as various commentators have pointed out, that's a radical difference in the US than what had been the case in the 60s. Where though you had so many white progressives joining the struggle, it was overwhelmingly people of color who were involved in this. So now you have all these white people, which is so important because whites have differential power in these societies. So you're going to sort of need to win over, if not all, at least a significant section of the white population for these movements to actually go forward. So that's very encouraging. Now, the question is this, however. Are the changes going to be limited to the symbolic level and not go very far in the substantive direction? So, you know, the taking down of statues, the banning of the Confederate flag in public places, the renaming of institutions named after historical racist figures, all that is great. And, you know, the symbolic is important in terms of sending a message to people. You are an equal in this society, not a stigmatized member, and so forth. Nonetheless, the symbolic cannot substitute for the substantive. And the substantive means things like, as I said, this huge wealth gap. It means the difference in employment rates. Black employment is usually, even in the best of times, it's about, you know, twice the rate of white unemployment. It means things like life expectancy and environmental racism. It means a radical reform of the educational system, which in the US is deeply segregated. You know, more than 60 years after the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954, which many people were hailing at the time, at last, sort of end of racism. And you know, you did have partial desegregation in the 70s and 80s, but then that was turned back. And there's been resegregation ever since. So in many parts of the country, the schools are now more segregated than they were at the time of Brown. And segregation has a sort of huge impact because of the fact that you don't get equal access to resources, so that, you know, students of color are disadvantaged from the very start. So there's a whole raft of measures. And one of the good things about the present period and all the stories there have been is that, you know, I subscribe to The Times, The Washington Post, The Guardian, and I'm sort of busy sort of cutting out newspaper stories, downloading PDFs, because there's all this stuff. It's amazing. In the US, racism is, you know, from every possible sphere, classical music, the fashion industry, romance novels, it's ubiquitous. And it's because, of course, it's basically at the very foundational level, as I said, it's saying some human beings are superior to others. So if you're one of those superior human beings, you're going to construct your life world about your fellow superior humans. You're going to keep at a distance the inferior humans. So it's unsurprising then that racism sort of permeates the entire social order. But in the consequence of that is that to have remedial measures of racial justice would require a radical reconstruction, overturning of that order. And as I say, it's easy. And I'm not, you know, putting down anybody. I think it's great, as I said, so many white people out there demonstrating, but it's much easier to demonstrate, to wear a t-shirt that says Black Lives Matter, and then come home and say, well, okay, I've done my duty. When in fact, you're coming home to a segregated neighborhood, you're coming back to segregated life chances, differential opportunities of, you know, access to opportunities and wealth and so forth. So those things are going to have to be changed, and the symbolic level alone is not going to achieve those kinds of change. And the question is, are whites or are a significant enough section of whites or the white population going to be willing to undertake the sacrifices that would probably be necessary for the transition to a non-racial social order?
So do you think it's possible to have a non-racial or non-racist state? And if so, what are those remedial actions that need to be taken?
Well, since you ask, so I'm just finishing up. So I was asked, you know, it was a real honor. I was asked to give the Tanner lecture this year. So there's a set of Tanner lectures given across the US and out in Britain. So this one was given at Michigan. And I took as my theme racial justice. And that was back in February, you know, before the Floyd killings. So in a sense, it was very timely. So I've just been sort of rewriting and it sort of polished up the final version to be sent in to be printed. So the argument I've given, and here I'm sort of referencing within philosophy, John Rawls's work, because he came up with these basic principles of justice. And my criticism of Rawls is that these are principles of justice for an ideal society. They're not principles of justice for actual non-ideal social systems. And next year, 2021, is the 50th anniversary of Rawls's book, A Theory of Justice, came out in 1971. And though he says himself explicitly, the point of doing ideal theory is to move on to non-ideal theory, the transition never takes place either in his own work or in his numerous, you know, disciples and followers. So that nearly 50 years later, in a country, United States, founded as a white settler state, sort of more overtly white supremacist state than, you know, most other of the Western colonial nations, racial justice as a theme is virtually completely absent from this large body of work on social justice. So I've done various pieces over the years critiquing Rawls and this, you know, the Tanner lecture, as I say, I'm writing up now. I argue for three principles of corrective racial justice. So end second-class civic status, end racial exploitation, and end racial disrespect. And my claim is that these principles are, in theory, principles that should be supported across the liberal spectrum. So as you know, Rawls on the left of the liberal spectrum is a social democrat, and his work wasn't fiercely contested by the political right, by people like Robert Nozick, the libertarian and in a right-wing liberal tradition. But I'm saying these principles of racial justice in theory should be supported across the liberal spectrum, even by the political right, because the violations involved in racial injustice are violations of rights that the political right should recognize. So for the political right, the key rights are Lockean rights, John Locke, life, liberty, property, and they would claim that, for example, to rights for decent education, for healthcare. These are not liberal rights, these are socialist rights. So you guys don't call yourself liberals, you're socialists. We are the ones who know what real liberal rights are. So the traditional battle between liberals of the right and the left over whether these rights can be called liberal or not. So the point I'm making is that you don't have to appeal to left-wing liberal rights to make a case for racial justice, because the violation of life, liberty, and property, as I say, these are right-wing rights, these are, you know, respectable rights that John Locke would recognize, they're all systematically violated by racial injustice. So these three principles, ending second-class citizenship status, ending racial exploitation, ending racial disrespect, all liberals should be able to sort of get on board with them. So in terms of, you know, cashing them out, second-class status, well, obviously, in the period of the European domination of the world, a world divided between, you know, humans and natives, I mean, that, you know, clearly, you know, people of color are second class then. In the British Empire, you may be a member of the empire, but you sort of are not an equal within it. So, and United States under the period of, you know, segregation, separate but equal, which was obviously unequal. So these are sort of clear-cut violations of, you know, basic rights of civic status. People are clearly second-class citizens. But I would claim that even now, Blacks and Latins in particular are still second-class citizens. Once you look at things like the widespread pattern of disenfranchisement. So, you know, ever since, you know, the Shelby Supreme Court decision, which rolled back the protections there had been for Black voters, you have a widespread practice of voter suppression, because the situation in the US is that people of color, certainly Blacks, to a certain extent, Latinos as well, though less so than Blacks, they tend to be Democratic, they tend to be liberal. So if you can suppress the votes of people of color, you have a better chance of maintaining Republican power. So that's why, you know, you have this sort of pattern across the country looking for different ways to suppress the Black vote. You know, sort of claims of voter fraud, which are, you know, completely bogus, claims that, you know, the dead people are voting and so forth. So first class citizenship status would mean a whole set of measures, ending voter suppression, rescinding the Shelby decision, and also in the whole sort of set of encounters of people of color with government institutions. It means that insofar as, you know, you're treated in an inferior way, it means you don't really have first-class citizenship in reality, whether you have it or not on paper. So it means massive reform of, like, in the prison industrial complex. It means either desegregation or a massive sort of funneling of resources into, you know, the segregated parts of the country. Because the idea is you're looking for substantive first-class civic status, not merely on paper. Then racial exploitation, what I mean by that is that you can develop a concept of exploitation that does not rely on the labor theory of value. So exploitation as a concept, classically associated with the left tradition, the Marxist tradition, and you know, once the labor theory of value is seen, even by most people on the left, where this doesn't really stand up, then, you know, it's sort of mainstream political philosophy, exploitation vanishes as a concept. But, you know, in recent years, people have begun to say, look, You can develop a concept of exploitation that does not rely on the labor theory of value. You develop a concept of exploitation in terms of inequitable treatment, a violation of norms of personhood. So there's now a growing body of work on exploitation. And within the liberal tradition, because you see, I'm trying to work with the liberal tradition, there's this idea of unjust enrichment, a respectable liberal idea. So you can say we need to expand the concept of unjust enrichment and then say, look at slavery. You don't need the labor theory of value to see that slavery is exploitative. Look at Jim Crow segregation. Look at the situation where Blacks are discriminated against when they apply for jobs. So there's a whole set of measures which sort of account for the fact of the huge, you know, wealth differential between white and Black and Latin households. And my argument is this is the outcome of racial exploitation. So ending racial exploitation would mean not merely looking at all the different measures whose cumulative outcome is to sort of give whites more wealth than they're, you know, actually morally entitled to, but would also mean correcting for this past legacy. You'd then make a case that the differences in wealth are the result of process of unjust enrichment. So within a respectable liberal tradition, we then need to sort of have measures of reparation to correct for this. And then finally, racial disrespect. Well, this is in a lot of the stuff we've been seeing in terms of the symbolism of monuments, because it's basically saying in the public sphere, here's this great Confederate hero who voted to keep slavery in existence. We won't have a lot of statues to this guy. Well, what does that say to you Black people? Well, clearly it shows that, you know, you did not deserve to be freed. So there's all these, you know, monuments, you know, the Woodrow Wilson, racist president and so forth. You know, racism runs so deep in the US that, you know, you have it sort of permeating all these spheres, and the level of symbolism, Native American sports mascots and team names and so forth. So there's all that symbolic stuff. But then in addition, there's things that have to do with, for example, representations of the body. So that a racially supremacist system also stigmatizes the bodies of those who do not belong to the privileged race. So particularly those bodies more deviant than, you know, the European norm. So some Asian groups are not that radically different in appearance. I mean, you know, the eyes may be different, but in terms of skin color, long hair and so forth. So, you know, you have sort of less stigmatization there. In the case of Blacks, most remote from the European bodily type, you then have a long history of, you know, disrespectful, racist caricatures of the Black body. And you find these like in cartoons and advertising, late 19th century, early 20th century, still quite late. If you look at, you know, old cartoons from the 30s and 40s, you have all these, you know, grotesque representations of Black people. And it manifests itself in ways that the Black body has to be disciplined when it appears in the public sphere. So that Black women's hair, for example, there's this long tradition that has been challenged in recent years, but it used to be the case, you have to have your hair straightened, your hair has to look this way, otherwise, you know, you cannot be, you know, employed in this position. So there's a whole set of issues concerned with the body and somatic stigmatization, and of course, linked with that, self-hate in some cases, because you don't see yourself as equally attractive because you have this stigmatized body. There's also issues having to do with testimony. And my colleague at City University CUNY Grad Center, a British philosopher, Miranda Fricker, with this very important book, Epistemic Injustice, and in sort of looking at the concept, which, you know, you had developed in like feminist theory. Basically, certain people are not seen as credible witnesses because they have a stigmatized identity. So if you just think of, you know, women and rape accusations, you know, that rarely happened. I mean, come on, weren't you really leading on blah, blah, blah. So long history with stigmatized groups that their testimony is not credible. And, you know, because of the fact that the profession, unfortunately, has been so white, more work has been done on gender, but it sort of manifests itself racially as well. So you have a long history, for example, of Black American academics, people in some cases with credentials from, you know, mainstream white institutions, and their testimony, in a sense, their analyses are not taken seriously. Classic example here is W.E.B. Du Bois, PhD from Harvard, 2 years at the University of Berlin. He can't get a job at a white university. It doesn't matter how many books and articles he's published. This is not a credible source. And you know, it then means that you know, you have the dominant analyses in the public sphere ignoring the perspectives of people of color because their testimony is not credible. So what I'm claiming is that you know, the equalization of officially recognized personhood, the ending of racial disrespect has multiple manifestations, and hearing the testimony, giving a fair hearing to the testimony of people of color is part of that. It doesn't mean you automatically accept it, of course, and that would be crazy. You don't accept anybody's views automatically, but you give it a fair hearing. So when Du Bois challenges mainstream sociology, you say, well, let's look at his arguments, rather than, which was the case, you just dismiss his arguments. So my claim is that these three principles of corrective racial justice would basically cover most of, you know, the many aspects of racial injustice that they are. So I'm hoping that, you know, this Tanner lecture will have some impact.
I live in Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and there the racial justice movement, it really centers around this figure of Black Pete. I don't know if you've heard about this.
Yes, I know. Blackface Black Pete, yes.
Exactly. Yeah, sure. And it's really every year around the time the festival happens in December. So from kind of November onwards, there's a really, really very strong struggle goes on around this figure. And some people kind of wonder why this struggle revolves around a symbol rather than, as you say, the substantive. But I think you've really shown how those three things are connected, how the different spheres are connected.
Yes, because, you know, disrespect, it's such a basic notion. So within ethics, you associate it most closely with Immanuel Kant, but you don't have to have read a single word of Kant. When you think of the Black American tradition, don't diss me. It's just sort of a very basic moral notion that is appreciated both at grassroots level and within, you know, academic theory. And, you know, disrespect, respect, they're so fundamental. And as I say, one way of sort of looking at race and racism is that racism is fundamentally predicated on racial disrespect for, you know, these stigmatized races. So you are not equal. You're not a person of the same moral standing as I am. Maybe you're not a person at all. Maybe you're really an animal, that sort of, you know, people think in as human, but you're really not human. So, you know, once you recognize how fundamental that is, then you see why it's going to manifest itself across a whole range of interactions. And in the representation of the non-white, as I said, the Black body in particular, you know, you don't find that at all to the same extent. I mean, there's a tradition of brown face and yellow face and so forth, like in movies. But the Black face tradition is the one that has had most impact, not just in the US, but basically globally. I mean, Britain, for example, less so now because, of course, of, you know, anti-racist activism. But the, you know, the British toy of the gollywog, you know, this grotesque figure with this, you know, these big red lips and so on. That's a racial representation. And in the heyday of empire, you know, that was routine. And, you know, you have, is it Enid Blyton, famous British children's author, you know, her books are filled with negative racial representations of various kinds. It's, again, as I say, this whole thing, it's, you know, to use the American legal language, it's not siloed, it's not cabined. You know, racism, you know, permeates, it sort of spreads outwards. And even things that some people might think are not important, such as, you know, the gollywog, such as, you know, Black Pete, it basically helps to support a mindset, and it helps to keep in place a particular perception, a way of looking at the racial other. So if you used sort of, if you're growing up with, you know, blackface representations, how is it going to affect when you see actual Black people? You know, it's going to be hard to sort of see them as equals, given these links. So that's why, you know, you need this sort of, you know, multidimensional battle on all these different fronts. The symbolic front, certainly, though, as I say, there's always a danger that it sort of remains at the symbolic level and doesn't go on to these other levels also.
And so these kind of three areas that you're talking about of racial justice or racial kind of remedial measures, presumably if those could be carried out, then you could create a non-racial or non-racist state.
Yes.
And how would that work on a global level, especially in terms of, because it, I think it revolves around the idea of citizenship and expanding citizenship, truly expanding citizenship to include all people within the boundaries of the state. But how does that work when it comes to the borders and who's excluded and migration and things like that?
Yes, of course. So it is limited in that respect. So I'm basically sort of, I'm drawing on, you know, Rawls's earlier work where he was focused, you know, on domestic justice. In later work, he moves to the international sphere, but here I was just focused on the domestic. And certainly for the international arena, it becomes much more complicated because you also have to take into account, for example, if you think of the case of people of color in the US, they're disadvantaged racially within the US, but because of the US's position in the world as a whole, they're unfairly advantaged with respect to many people outside the United States. So you then have to talk about, you know, the history of imperialism and colonialism and terms of trade and in sort of global structures of advantage and disadvantage. So that involves a much more complicated picture. So that's one I sort of have not tried to tackle yet, but you're absolutely right. That issues of immigration, for example, which are so crucial in the US, in Europe, issues of immigration have to sort of be put in the context of why are so many people trying to come to our countries? And usually it's in a kind of vacuum. We're just this great nation, so obviously everyone wants to come here. But you have to look at the history of, you know, the exploitation of these nations and that has left them structural disadvantage. So the opportunities people would have had in a more globally equitable order, they don't have these opportunities. And the countries that have benefited from these transnational patterns of exploitation, they're the ones with the wealth, they're the ones with the opportunities, which, you know, will likely be less than for the white citizens, but are nonetheless often better than the opportunities you would have in the global south. So it means immigration as an issue has to be understood within this larger global context, which again is going to involve race insofar as you had a domination that was in a sense a global white domination, insofar as European powers dominate the rest of the planet. And race was sort of crucial to the ideological rationale for that. So you have to look at issues of global racial justice also, when these issues of boundaries, immigration, what people are entitled to in terms of the resources of their own country. Is it the case that these resources are, shall we say, clean? Or is it the case that these resources have also, in part, been the result of a legacy of colonialism and slavery? So that, you know, in the West European nations, one is sitting on wealth that has been extracted from other nations. So that's why, you know, we really do need to sort of understand how central race has been to the making of the modern world.
And you mentioned before about the possibility, a possible opening towards a transracial, transnational kind of racial justice movement. How can such a movement grow and be nurtured and be successful? Are there particular obligations of white people in such a movement, or are there particular obligations of people of color? How to create and sustain and build that transracial movement?
Well, there's a sense in which the, to me, utterly surprising, unexpected success of, you know, the Black Lives Matter Black Lives Matter movement, picking up on Floyd's murder in globalizing these issues, shows that there's a possible base there, sort of makes one more optimistic than one might otherwise have been. So across all these nations, and these questions have been raised about race, so wouldn't it be great if there was a lasting organizational consequence of these movements? So it's not just that people came to the demonstration for a few days, and then, you know, after a while, as was inevitable, the demonstrations died down and nothing is left. But that, you know, people try to establish or, you know, sort of reinforce, I mean, in many cases, anti-racist movements already exist, reinforce and, you know, build upon existing movements that, you know, could ultimately be combined into a global network. And, you know, there have been, I think, in attempts in the past, but usually it's been just stuff on paper with not much actual significance in terms of support and so forth. But if it were the case that, you know, people's conscience, consciousness and conscience were sufficiently raised, you know, by, you know, the Floyd murder, by comparable stories coming out of, you know, France, Britain, Canada, Australia, in some cases, focus more on the experience of Indigenous peoples and, you know, deaths in police custody. So you could then have a sort of set of global questioning. How has racism affected the modern world? How have we, asking from the white point of view, how have we as whites benefited unfairly from this? We can't be held responsible for the past, and that's completely irrational, obviously. But, you know, given that we're now born into this situation with this structure in existence, what can we do to help dismantle it to move towards a racially equitable global order? So that's what, you know, the idea would be if, you know, the legacy of the protests around Floyd, of the consciousness raising of Black Lives Matter, could lead to movements, lasting movements in all these nations with some kind of, you know, global, not a single unit coordinated. I mean, that's unrealistic, but an awareness of the fact that it's a global problem and that apart from the national issues, there are also transcontinental issues in terms of the legacy of imperialism and colonialism and in terms of the structures, you know, set up after World War II and, you know, how those structures in crucial respects help to bolster and reproduce the unfair advantages of the previous formal colonial order. So the whole critique, as of course you know, the post-colonial critique is that it's not really post at all. We are still living in that kind of order, even though it no longer designates itself as such. In terms of structures of power and advantage and hegemony, that order, though challenged, arguably, to a certain extent by, could say, China or at one stage the BRIC nations, though I think we've heard less of that recently, that order still exists. So how can we dismantle that order for a global village, more, you know, more of us coming into close contact with each other, moving towards a global catastrophe? Because as I say, you know, we don't really have that much time left in terms of the accelerate, you know, this new stories I've seen, which I'm sure you've been seeing as well, is that the gloomy predictions of many scientists of when the melting was going to happen and the methane and the permafrost was going to be released and so forth. This is all happening much quicker than even the worst case scenarios. So the amount of time we have left for climate justice and just straight planetary survival is very short. So another question would be, is there going to be a tension between the racial justice movement and, you know, the climate justice movement? There shouldn't be, because climate injustice differentially affects those who are most vulnerable, who will usually be in the Western nations, people of color, or, you know, in the global South, sort of poorer nations as a whole. So could you combine in a concern about these two major problems, and of course there are more as well, but the impending climate catastrophe, the ongoing realities of racial injustice across a whole set of different nations as well as transnationally, could you combine them into some movement that could really mobilize people? I mean, that would be great. I don't know how realistic it is, but that would be wonderful, obviously.
There is actually, Yanis Varoufakis and his colleagues have set up an organization called Progressive International with the idea of
okay, great.
Your Right. Very, very new. So we'll have to see what happens. But
absolutely. Fingers crossed.
Yes, yeah, so there's some hope. I do have two last questions if you have the time.
Sure.
Firstly, you're talking about kind of white supremacy and white privilege and kind of white people, the need for white people to kind of acknowledge those structures and in a way their privilege. But what do you say to people? I think there are a lot of white people, and I know some of them, who don't feel very privileged and who find it very difficult, find the idea of them having privilege very difficult because they don't have any money. What do you say to them?
It's a very important question, especially as I say, in the time of economic crisis, when many white people themselves are really suffering. So it might seem utterly absurd. What do you mean white privilege? I mean, unemployed, I'm on the verge of being thrown out of my apartment because I can't pay the rent and so forth. So it has to be approached in a subtle and comprehensive fashion. There's a philosopher who works on race, Shannon Sullivan, and Shannon has written one of those, you know, short, useful books specifically on this topic, white privilege. And that's one of the issues she addresses. She's white herself. So, you know, she's sort of alive to, you know, these kinds of objections that, you know, people would raise. So it's going to involve in part drawing comparisons so that, you know, you often can make a case that the situation is even worse for people of color. So that, yes, you may have very little money left, but, you know, here are people who have nothing at all. Here are people who are in debt. There are statistics in terms of how many Americans have savings that, you know, could sort of carry them through a month or two. And often it's the case that people who have very little in the bank might have money in mortgages and a car, which people of color don't have. So in part, you're going to make it comparative. And you're also going to point to other kinds of dimensions than straight economic ones. White privilege, for example, in terms of political access, done by the fact that in the history of the United States, of course, you can point out similar things, or worse for other Western nations. There's been one black president of color in the entire history, in terms of the composition of, you know, the Senate and the House, in terms of mayors and so forth. There's, you know, political stuff. There's cultural stuff. So if you see white privilege as multidimensional, and then point out that even in a time of economic crisis for everybody, whites as a group, and also whites, I mean, you can break things down in economic terms as economists do, like deciles, you know, tenths of the population or quintiles, and you say, okay, here's the bottom quintile, bottom decile of the white population, the bottom quintile or decile of your black population. Look, it turns out, you know, you guys do have more money than the ones in the black one. But you're absolutely right to raise that question, because simply just sort of chanting white privilege, that's not going to win people over, especially in a time of economic crisis. And what I think you have to sort of link that, this emphasis on, you know, sort of historicizing it, is holding out the possibility of a social order where people at the bottom, no matter what their race, can do better. So, you know, it's obviously the case when you're trying to appeal to people of color, since, you know, they've been the primary people disadvantaged, you know, by white domination, by white supremacy. But you also need to make a case, I believe, I mean, this is in part with my general thing that moral suasion is going to have a limited appeal. Can you do better as a white working class person? And in many countries, I think you can make that case. And certainly you can make that case in the United States, which is the richest country in the world, and has either the most inequitable income and wealth distribution, or one of the, somebody said to me that maybe England or France is a bit more inequitable on one of them, income or wealth, but it's certainly at or near the top. So you'd basically be saying to the white working class, to the white poor, the white unemployed, you guys have historically been privileged with respect to blacks, and here are the stats to prove it, even if, you know, things are not as good now as they once were. But in terms of going forward, wouldn't it be better for all of us, those at the bottom of the social ladder, to have a more equitable society, to have the riches of the United States, as I say, other Western nations apply the argument there also, distributed in a more equitable fashion. So going back to Thomas Piketty's book, now a bit dated, but in his crucial analysis, we're in the new Gilded Age, where it's not so new anymore. So the age of plutocracy, the age of extreme income and wealth differences, and the fear that this Gilded Age is going to last longer than the others. So in the US, the classic Gilded Age was one Mark Twain originally wrote about, this 80s, 90s, and then the 1920s, also the Jazz Age, and then of course the crash, the Great Depression. So this is the third Gilded Age, and it may last longer than all of them. So you appeal to white working class folks and say, where do you think your kids, where do you think your grandkids are going to be in 10, 20, 30 years' time if this system continues as before? Do you think they're going to be able to get into a good university? And there are amazing statistics on, you know, how few white working class people are represented in the elite American institutions. That may be like 5% are sort of, you know, working class whites or something like that. Where do you think things are going to be in terms of declining life expectancies, in terms of, you know, jobs drying up and so forth? So you try to create a transracial agenda of the poor and the unemployed, the working class, the sort of traditional left dream, which, you know, in the US has been tried at various times and it has always run up against race as a barrier. But you could say that the times now are more propitious for that political agenda than ever before. So you're not just, you know, calling white people out on white privilege, you're also saying, here's a society, a more redistributivist social order that could be better for all of us.
Thanks. I did have one last question, which is more of a kind of academic question, I suppose. I find it really interesting that you've been so critical of liberal democracy,
yes,
but you still work within the liberal...
I know. I've run into trouble with various people for that, I can tell you.
Why do you choose to kind of try to revive the tradition or resurrect the tradition or rescue the tradition?
Right. Well, you can't say resurrect because, of course, it's still alive and well. It's been under attack by, you know, right-wing ethno-nationalism. But and you could say they've won in certain places. They've won in India so far, some East European countries, but they haven't won, you know, sort of across the board yet. So, so it's more a matter of reviving the progressive potential of the tradition. And one counter-argument would be for critics is, what alternative are you offering? Because you see, if the alternative is in a more left program, I would say that liberalism, you know, can accommodate that. I'm using liberalism in the broad sense, certainly not neoliberalism. I'm using the sense that includes social democracy and even socialism. So I'm using liberalism for a specific set of values, classical in terms of flourishing of individual. And then the question of what particular social system is most conducive to that is for me an open question. So, you know, you could have an anti-capitalist liberal critique if you can say, here's an alternative system which does better than capitalism has, but that capitalism can, in sort of guaranteeing individual flourishing, individual realization, apart from those few privileged, you know, the people in the, well, you know, the upper class, you know, the wealthy and so forth. So there's that argument. There's also the argument that any kind of radical change is going to require legal change. These systems are kept in place by a number of factors. Ideology is certainly one. There's resort to force. That's a possible factor as well. But the legal system is part of it. The legal system is a liberal legal system. It's sort of founded on liberal principles. So in arguing for legal change, you know, you need to have an awareness of, you know, the presuppositions of liberalism as a political ideology, and then to show that if you're genuinely committed to the protection of individual rights and individual flourishing and in making sure that people don't suffer from social injustice, then you can show where liberalism has historically been racialized. That's the subject of you know, the book that came out a few years ago, Black Rights, White Wrongs. And my argument there was that a principled anti-racist liberalism in, you know, the 17th, 18th centuries would have condemned slavery, would have condemned European imperialism and European colonialism. We take for granted that liberalism is, you know, utterly corrupt and bankrupt because it was on board with all of these programs. And most of the leading liberal theorists were themselves racists. And in some cases, actually employees. John Stuart Mill, classically, employee of, you know, the British East India, if I got that right. John Locke, you know, had his colonial role as well, helped write the Carolina Constitution. So actual liberalism, the past few hundred years, has been complicit with white supremacy. But then my argument is, does it have to be that way? And my opponents would say, yes, it does. And I would say, show me where, within the foundations of liberal theory, it has to be the case that liberalism is pro-imperialist, pro-colonialist, pro-racist. And you can't, in fact, show that. And you can then have a revised anti-racist liberalism, which says, given that existing liberalism has been racialized, what would a de-racialized liberalism look like? And just as feminist liberalism is radically different from patriarchal liberal theory, my claim would be that an anti-racist liberalism would be radically different from existing white supremacist liberal theory. So my claim would be that liberalism is already here. The people you're arguing with are liberals. The legal system is a liberal one. You make a more effective case if you can show that by liberalism's own lights, once deracialized, radical structural reform is called for.
Thank you very much. On that note, I'll let you go. Thanks so much for answering all my questions and for talking to us and for your patience.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks very much, Charles.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Our Voices podcast from Open Democracy. If you enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen, why not head to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a review? Open Democracy is an independent global media platform that is only possible because of your kind donations. To find out more or to make a donation, head to opendemocracy.net.